Okay. What do you got for me today?
So yesterday we were talking a lot, or you were talking a lot about using the conventions and the rules and things to learn about our intentions and sort of the dynamic of conduct and view and things. And you ended with a story about how this gangster came and lived with Lungpa Cha. And I was just wondering about the role of mentors and teachers in helping us to learn these very difficult skills.
How we learn. You can't read a book on this, or you can, but it doesn't really hit you in the same way, because this is really restructuring, rewiring, reconfiguring our whole being, and having mentors, and of course that's what Sangha is, as opposed to some big Ajahn or something, that because for all of Ajahn Chah's, say, charisma and character, he never set himself apart, and the other senior members of the community were very, very much a part of the whole training process. Of course, it's under the guidance of Ajahn Chah, or in any monastery, the teacher does provide guidance and encouragement, but it's also the living with the whole community and the members of the community who perform all the different roles of mentoring, which sometimes is agreeable and sometimes it's disagreeable. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't, and it's very human, which is good, in the sense of, because sometimes even seeing, senior monks not behaving so well, it doesn't mean that they're not good monks. It's just that they're not behaving well at that moment, or they're not in a good mood at that time, or their own mindfulness and clarity has issues. So there's but certainly as the senior monk or the senior Ajahn has a duty to try to be the example, and to try to encourage people in both the aspects of vinaya and conduct, as well as the practice itself, meditation practice, the understanding of the teaching. So that's there is a mentoring going on many different levels, but I suppose there's a certain tone set by your senior monk, and that provides a good foundation for the tone of the monastery itself, hopefully, you realize that this. The learning that we're doing is not just a meditation technique or a astute philosophical perspective. It's it's living the Dhamma day in, day out, and living the training day in and day out. And so that takes support and encouragement from all the members of the community, really, and commitment of all the members of the community. So we are mentored, and we do grow. And certainly for myself, I mean, my own understanding of Dhamma and my own commitment to Dhamma has grown through my being a teacher or an abbot, and being willing and ready to learn from others, learning from the situation, learning from other people, so that it's not just a kind of a top-down, the abbot holding all the knowledge and passing it out at his discretion when he feels magnanimous, everybody's learning from each other, and that's an aspect of mentoring, in that we are being mentored by Dhamma Vinaya, and mentored by the living within the refuges of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha. So.
I'm just wondering who you might consider important mentors over your own time.
My own time? Lopa Cha. Lumpa Chan, Lumpa Mahamon, Lumpa Liam, those are all sort of senior teachers of Ajahn Chah, Lumpa Sumedho. So those are all mentors who lived with, had a lot of contact with, teachers who I had not constant contact with, or regular contact with, but who were very influential in my own practice. And Nukdan Mahabua, Nupan Pan, Nupan Buddha Tat, Prabhu Yuto, these are all monks who I drew close to for shorter, as opportunistic times when I had the opportunity. I went down to Suan Mok at least three times, maybe four, hard to remember. And I've had occasions to visit with and speak Dhamma with Prabhu Yuto, similarly with Nukdal Mahabua, Lumpa Ben. So those that's what pops up on the top of my head. But people who I was close to, besides Ajahn Chah, and Lopa Jan was one of the senior disciples of Ajahn Chah, and he was really good with Westerners. He had a good feel for Westerners, and Lopa Mahamon, I had a lot of contact with him because he was the preceptor for all the Western monks while I was the abbot of Wat Nanachat. So I had a lot of contact with him, and he was a very learned monk. It was really who got very inspired by Ajahn Chah. And it took him quite a long time to make the commitment to go and train with Ajahn Chah, because he was a senior teacher at the Pali Institute that Ajahn Chah dropped out of. I can't do that. But then, when he finally went and met Ajahn Chah, then he gave up his position and came and studied with Ajahn Chah. And he was very well known in Ubon, because the monastery that he was the senior teacher at was really respected and renowned, and it was a big thing, big deal, when Ajahn Mahamon went to stay with Ajahn Chah, and Lumpa Sumedho was there before Ajahn Mahamon, even though Ajahn Mahamon was quite a bit senior. Similar to Lumpa Liam. Lumpa Liam came after Lumpa Sumedho was there. He was already, I think, 9 punsas or something when he went to stay with Ajahn Chah. And of course, Lumpa Liam I've had a lot of contact with over the years, both as a young monk and then particularly when Ajahn Chah was ill. It's hard to imagine now, but when Lumpa Liam first took over as senior teacher performing the duties of abbot of Wat Bapong, then Wat Bapong almost kind of cleared out. And of course, everybody wanted Ajahn. They didn't want Lumpa Liam. They wanted Ajahn Chah. So, and you get compared to you're not doing it like Lumpa. So it's very, very tough, very hard. And I made it a point of making sure that I stayed close to Wat Bapong and Lumpa Liam and help support him all the way through. So he was... he's not a gusher. sometimes it's hard to even know if he acknowledges your existence, he definitely has appreciated our contact over the years.
In Lumpur, coming to the West, it seems like our tradition has the chance to sort of come into contact not only with Western culture, but also with all these other branches of Buddhist monasticism, Tibetan and Zen lineages, etc. What strengths do you see in these other lineages and in Western culture that you think maybe, our tradition could benefit from kind of looking to or taking in? And number two, coming to the West, how have you decided which elements of our korwat and how we hold the form to adjust to the culture, and how have you decided which to stick to?
Well, I think that's a big question.
It's two big questions, actually.
But we had these later years haven't had much contact with other traditions very much. For early years of Abhaya Giri, we had quite a lot of contact with Tibetan Zen, both in terms of Bay Area Zen and say like Shasta Abbey, which is a Zen tradition, but it's got a very strong monastic community and commitment to monastic form, whereas the most of the Zen, as it's found in the States, is they're priests, they're not monastics, and you know, later years just haven't had the same amount of contact. We used to go. There used to be a Western Buddhist monastic gathering pretty much every year, and I got kind of tired of them. I think others did too. You know, it's wonderful to connect with all these, you know, sincere people, but oftentimes there was, I think our strongest connection was really Shasta Abbey, because they had a strong commitment to monastic training and lived a really exemplary community life. So and I haven't been these last years since my hip and pelvis has been sort of precluded long road trips. And I've definitely tried to be supportive of the monastic communities that are being formed by the bhikkhunis, Aloka Vihara, Dhammadharini, and be supportive because they're focused on monastic training, so that you know, kind of, because there's so many good things to do, that you know, it could be, you know, running around the country doing good things, and I'd rather focus my attention here, of course, you know, one of you know, there are, you know, certainly the you know, some of the aspects of, you know, I think one of the things that really hit me early years of that Western Buddhist monastic gathering, that really struck me, and I don't know, it was at Shasta Abbey, and it was when we had the sort of the Buddhist monastic fashion show. And explaining our robes and the background of the robes and the tradition around the robes, and what was really fascinating was that as different as all these robes are, whether it's Chinese tradition or Theravada tradition or Tibetan or Zen, is the attempt, and because there's a problem of geography and history that has separated all these traditions, and because of the distances, both in time as well as in physical distances, and I mean, it's only really now in this modern age that we have the ability to communicate with these other traditions, and all the different lineages talking about their robes and how the attempt was always to try to go back to the texts that they had and understand what these what does it mean by the, you know, like the underrobe, or what does it mean by the, like for the longest time, Chinese tradition, like City of 10,000 Buddhas, they put two robes on, two of the their robes on, their outer robes on, for the ordinations, because you know they're really trying to follow this, what's in the Vinaya text, but they didn't quite know what it was, the attempts by Dogen he was really really looking down on the way that these kind of the upper robe and the lower robe were getting sewn in together and turning into one kind of smock type thing, and was really down on that. So that's the roots of your Soto Zen tradition, but that always the attempt is trying to be as faithful as possible, and that was really that was really quite touching and moving, and the use of the or even say in the Tibetan tradition where they live in this incredibly harsh climate, we've got these. I mean, they keep a bare shoulder. You know, they've got kind of a jacket thing, but they keep a bare shoulder because that's what it is in the Vinaya, and they probably have to get covered up with all sorts of sheep carcasses. wool and sheepskins to keep warm, because it is an incredibly harsh environment. But that's the vineyard. There it is in the vineyard. They want to really protect that, and so that's something that was really quite inspiring. Because oftentimes what we do is we look at the external, and those shameless sort of Mahayanists, and you realize, a lot of it is the just these distances of geography and time, and that the attempt has been pretty constant. So that appreciating those qualities, and certainly in the in the Tibetan tradition, then there's certain aspects of the structuring of practices you have your preliminary. For us, as especially Thai tradition, and any kind of structuring and ordering is a bit. Bit anathema, but in Tibetan tradition, then you've got some, they're very prescribed practices that you lay a foundation with, and then you go on and you continue with that. So there's a structuring of within that, plus the teachings, and so there are. Certain practices and approaches that are worthy of taking note of and seeing their benefit. In terms of Kawatna and Vinaya coming to the West, and You know, you realize there's a, you know, Ajahn Sumedho was the first monk to go to the West, and he went into a culture that had quite a strong foundation in Buddhist studies and knowledge of Buddhism. The Buddhist Society had been around for a long time. Polytech Society even longer. It had a lot of academic and practice elements. You know, so many people were, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't live like this in England. And Ajahn Sumedho was sort of, oh, I don't know, I just want to try. And try to live this and figure it out from there. And then, you know, as one picks up the training and you realize, well, it's, you know, one, you know, the Buddha was pretty good at recognizing what is, you know, has a universal application, and sort of the commitment to a life of simplicity. And that's something as well, as when you meet, when I've met, not just monastics in the Buddhist tradition, but you meet Christian monastics in particular, you know, we've got a lot more in common than we do with Buddhist, certainly Buddhist lay teachers, because those principles of simplicity and renunciation that's the foundation of the monastic vocation, and the Vinaya certainly puts it in place, and the certain elements of that are quite sacrosanct, in that, yeah, life of celibacy, no money, no alcohol or drugs. Those as a fundamental foundation, you've already, you know, set yourself apart from about 99.9% of the population, which is setting up a training, and then you have, you know, different elements of because you can't really take, oh, I want, there's no reason to fit into American culture. So there's certain elements of, there's one of the there isn't much of a precedent for this is fundamentally a Protestant culture. It's within my lifetime that it was, you know, this huge thing that JFK was actually able to be elected as president of the United States, and he was a Catholic. You know, it's a that's a things have changed. But it's, yeah, it's just this the perception, and many of the values are, you know, and even now, for the generation now sort of looks back at that and sort of, well, that's really quaint. But it history has a way of showing itself over time. And I think that we have, you know, we've got a training that is you know, reasonably comprehensive in giving us the foundations of mindfulness and communal living, and supportive of the monastic and spiritual religious endeavor. So it's you know, and some things you know, I really didn't want to bring to America. It was just that, you know, from day one, I didn't want to bring like a receiving cloth as a I just didn't see the point of it. It's just, you end up spending more time explaining it and alienating people while you're doing it. So that, but you know, there's a few things that that have been a bit of an adaptation. But it's like, you know, a lot of it is just practice. I mean, even just our, you know, having a jacket like this. And it's like, it was really great. 1 year, they, you know, it was just, you live in a cold climate. And it was something that, you know, I was in Chitterst. The early years of Chitterst, and in those days, heat in the buildings were mostly not there, and then they're scattered around in little odd places where they were just trying to, you know, like the first I can't remember how long. But pretty much all the monks had to share their rooms with people. They didn't have kutis yet. They had to share. And it was like, it was a few years where they were, you know, sharing rooms. Ajahn Amaro was, there was one kuti in near the house there. But him and Tanawaro shared it for a couple of years. And then it was, you know, so but it was cold, and it's cold in England, and everybody had sweaters on, and they're all different colors, and Ajahn Sumedho was just sort of, this looks so sloppy, he asked Ajahn Munindo to come up with some sort of simple design that we can have a jacket that you could put whatever sweaters you need underneath it, and it looks monastic. So that he had at that time a close friend of his who was a Korean monk. So he used modeled off the Korean tradition, and. Anyway, that was really criticized in Thailand, as not so much in Wat Bapong circles, although some, to some extent, but certainly in the especially like administrative circles and the hierarchy. And then 1 year, a very senior monk from Wat Bawan, and he was the secretary to the Mahathera Samako, is a spacing on his name right now. I traveled with him and was his attendant and translator when he went. And No, different monk. I'll think about it. But anyway, he was very, very influential in the world of Sangha politics, and being at Wat Bawan, which is the heart of Damyut, that's the head of the Damyut, very influential, and he when he went to England, and we were there for a month and traveled around, and we put out sweaters and jacket for him, and he, no. And we said, okay, maybe he's really down on us, and thinks we're really, and this is in the summertime, and it's cold, even in the summer. And then the night before he left, he went around to all the different monasteries. And the night before he left, as we were taking leave and asking for forgiveness, he praised the practice. He praised the standards of Vinaya, and then he said, you know, when I was in Thailand, you know, I would hear criticisms of say Ajahn Sumedho and Ajahn Chah's tradition, going to England and adapting, not doing it like Thailand. And he said, so I made a determination to try it out, and I did. And then he said. And now you can see my arm here. It's all cracked and bleeding. And it's really, it was, he said, this is really not, what you've done is really appropriate for the environment, and how you've done it is appropriate. I'm going to take this back and show people that you can't be done. You know, so that it was really quite touching. Those are ways. There's, you know, you just have to sort of, you know, some things are you know, different from the way is a part of American culture, but I think it's something that is. There are many beautiful things that we can learn, because I mean we have our culture, but it doesn't mean it, because culture is a conditioned thing, it's a conventional thing, but there, we'll say that. For us as Buddhist monastics and Buddhist practitioners, what we're trying to do is set conditions that give us the opportunity for learning, and so that the opportunity to learn how to look after each other, and there's a very strong cultural value of independence and everybody, you know, really take care of themselves, which is that has a strength, and but then also to be able to learn how to adapt and how do we look after others, how do we care for others, how can we manifest qualities of, say, respect or deference, because despite a very strong ethos of equality, America right now is one of the more unequal cultures and countries on the planet. So that's a great ethos, but it's not really lived, and as a human culture, what are human qualities that we can be cultivating that allows us to live together in a way that we're not making more suffering than we started with.
Before, you talked about your relationship with your mentors in the East and with the Christian monastics, and I'm wondering if you've had much strong relationships with some lay teachers here in the West, or some have come and spent a lot of time here over the 25 years.
Some lay teachers?
Yeah, with the Buddhist lay teachers.
I have a very good connection with Gil Fronsdal. Guy and Sally have both come up and spent time. Guy Armstrong, Sally Armstrong, they've come up and spent time here, practiced here, joined in the Thanksgiving retreat. Their younger teachers, like Heather Sundberg, come up and spent time. She's a good, solid teacher. Betsy Rose, another teacher, has come up and spent time here. So yeah, within the lay teacher realm, there are some people who looked at Kevin Griffiths, Philip Moffat. Kevin's come up and spent time. Took him years to sort of get over that hump of, God, those monastics. He quite likes it. Philip Moffat never stayed, but he's got a real strong appreciation for the tradition, the lineage.
Rick Center,
yeah. I mean, he's a lay teacher who's got a place.
Have you mentioned Noah Levine?
Yeah, Noah's come up, and he's got a strong appreciation, and of course he's the early years he would plug in quite a bit, and now he's busy with many things. I saw him in Thailand a couple of years ago. I said, it's been so long since I've been to the monastery, I really have to get there. Okay, let's have a break.